Deuteronomy, and I guess everybody's got questions. Or the book of Deuteronomy is a book that has, I think, special impact and meaning for us as God's people when we consider the fact that the book of Deuteronomy was written for a people that were on the edge, on the brink of entering into the promised land. They were a people who had been coming through the wilderness, and now they were still heirs, not yet inheritors, but were on the edge of entering the promised land. And in that sense, that parallel, that analogy certainly has application to us. We went through Numbers last time and we saw the trek through the wilderness and how God zeroed in on certain things that are examples for us in terms of the type of obstacles that we will encounter in our trek through the wilderness. There are things that we need to be reminded of, need to be mindful of, as we stand on the brink of being inheritors. The book of Deuteronomy focuses much on the covenant relationship with God. The covenant was introduced in Exodus. The covenant was violated by the people of God who made that covenant. And now Deuteronomy is a renewal, a reiteration of the covenant. The beginning portion, the first most of the first four chapters, from chapter 1 on down to chapter 4, verse 43, is what is called the first discourse. It is more of a historical review. Moses looks back and helps the people assess and remember from whence they came, the circumstances of their journey. And that is important for us, that we look back, that we understand from where we come, from where God has called us, that we sort of get in perspective. That's one of the things that history does, is it helps to put things in perspective for us. And so Moses gave them an overview of their history and of the events that had occurred from the time of the Exodus until that had brought them right up to this moment. Then most of the book of Deuteronomy, beginning at the end of, right near the end of chapter 4, just in the last few verses, starting in chapter 4, verse 44. This is the law which Moses set before the children of Israel. And these are the testimonies, the statutes, the judgments. And it goes on down through the end of chapter 26 as to one long discourse that Moses gave, reiterating the laws by which Israel was to live, the basis of their covenant with God. The third discourse is just a matter of four chapters, 27, 28, 29, and 30, that are primarily warning and prediction about what the future holds. Then chapter 31 records Moses entrusting the written law to the leaders of Israel, to the Levites. Chapter 32 contains the Song of Moses, which it centers around Israel's responsibility to the covenant. Chapter 32 and 33 give Moses' final charge and farewell, and then chapter 34 is sort of a P.S., a postscript on the book that tells the account, gives the account of Moses' death and burial. If you were counting, you notice that those are seven sections into which the book of Deuteronomy falls. Let's start here in the beginning and look at several things as we start here, Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 1, these are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel on this side of the Jordan in the wilderness. They were 11 days journey there from Horeb by way of Mount Seir, the Kadesh Barnea. This was in the 40th year in the 11th month on the first day of the month. So this is just a matter of about 2.5 months short of exactly 40 years since the beginning of the Exodus. They have... this is the 40th year, not quite to the end of that 40th year. It is the beginning of the 11th month. So that meant the 11th and 12th months, those 2 months, plus then the first 2 weeks of the first month, which would bring them up to the time of the Passover and the Exodus. So they're just 2.5 months short of 40 years. Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and this is after the slaughter of the those on the east side of the Jordan. And Moses began to declare this law, and he begins to go back and rehearse a little bit as to what God had done. And he said, verse 7, "Turn you, take your journey, go to the mount of the Amorites and to all the places near there, in the plain, in the hills, the vale, the valley, the south, by the seaside, to the land of the Canaanites, to Lebanon, to the great river, the river Euphrates." So God had given them a great area that he was going to set before them. He told them to go in, set the land before you, go in and possess it. God had multiplied them. Moses reminded them of certain things, how he had gone to God, just been overwhelmed by the magnitude of the job. And God had instructed him, and how he took chief men from the tribes, verse 15, made them captains, instructed the judges, told them in verse 17 they were not to respect the persons in judgment, to hear the small as well as the great, not to be afraid of man, but they were standing in the place of God. So they departed from Horeb, Mount Sinai, went through the wilderness, and reminds them of the story of sending in the spies to the land and how they rebelled against God by not trusting him and not following and going on. And so that story is recounted, and except for Caleb and Joshua, God had said in verses 35 and 36 that that generation would not enter in. And so he reminds them, because you see, they are the ones. This is a young crowd. You think of the group that was standing there, and you realize that with just a handful of exceptions, there was nobody 60 years old or older in the group. There was, Joshua and Caleb, perhaps maybe their wives. They're not mentioned directly. But most likely that would certainly be included. Moses, really no indication of anybody else other than just that handful that would be over 60. It is a young group. These were people who were less than 20 years of age at the time of this earlier incident. So he reminds them of that and of this 40 years through the wilderness and what was the case. And so chapter 2, we turned, took our journey unto the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. And he reminds them of some of the story as to how they had come through and what they what they had encountered. And the giants that God had eliminated for them, as it mentions in verses 20 and 21. And so then again, this brings us on down. And in chapter 3, he begins to how they went up the way to Bashan. Talks about Og, king of Bashan, and how he was overcome, and the cities that were conquered. And the cities, verse 5, of chapter 3, were fenced with high walls, gates, bars, and so there were all these various things, but that they were taken as a prey by the Israelites, the two kings of the Amorites mentioned in verse 8 that were executed. And Og, the king of Bashan, was the remnant of the giants. Mentioned in verse 11. His bedstead was a bedstead of iron. It was 9 cubits long, 4 cubits wide. That doesn't mean he was necessarily 9 cubits, but it was. So we would assume it was a little bigger than he was. He was evidently a giant of a man. You know, 9 cubits, you're looking approximately 13 to 14 feet when you're looking at 9 cubits. So we don't know exactly how big Og was, but his bed was about 14 feet long. So that was the original king size bed, and this area, one of the things, of course, that had happened was Moses recounts this, tribe of Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh had wanted to take their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan, the land of Gilead, the land of Bashan. And they had agreed that the men would go forward. They assured Moses that they were not trying to get out of helping the Israelites, the rest of the Israelites, overcome the Canaanites in the Promised Land, but rather that this was land that was for good grazing land, pasture land, land for cattle and sheep. They had a lot of herds, a lot of cattle, and so they said, our men, our soldiers, will go in the forefront, but we'll leave our wives and our little ones behind and our animals, and we will go to the forefront. We'll do everything to help you take the land, but then we want our inheritance on this side. Moses had agreed to that, and he recounts the story here in chapter 3. In chapter 4, therefore hearken, O Israel, to the statutes, to the judgments that I teach you, for to do them, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers gives you. You shall not add unto the word which I command you, neither shall you diminish from it, that you might keep the commandments. So God reminds them of what had happened at Baal Peor, he says, I have taught you statutes and judgments. Verse 6, keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom, your understanding in the sight of the nations. This was, you know, if you obey God, it is a source of tremendous wisdom. He says, this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations. You know, when we apply the principles of God's law in our lives, there are benefits and results that we reap. And it is something that will certainly make us stand out. Because if Israel, to the extent that they did this, this certainly would make them stand out among all the nations round about. And they would, in that sense, be an example, be a light. So Moses told them, verse 9, only take heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, but teach them to your sons and your sons' sons. You know, it's an interesting thing to go through the Bible and to make a study of the places where God tells us to remember and the things and where He warns us about forgetting. There are many places in the Scripture where it warns about lest you forget. Beware lest you forget. So if you go through there and just notice that, you begin to realize, well, evidently God perceived that human beings are a pretty forgetful bunch. It's amazing how short our memory and attention span seems to be. That's one of the reasons it's good for us to think back and to remember. I've seen people who have experienced tremendous miracles in their lives, dramatic miracles of healing, dramatic miracles of this, that, or the other way. And yet, you would think in the aftermath of that, they would never forget. But you know, as time went by, they did. I mean, it was very much on their memory for a very short time. But time went by, and they forgot. And they drifted back into old patterns and old ways. And it is It is something that can happen. And so that's why, you know, Deuteronomy literally means second law. Deutero. It's a Greek word, means second law. It is a second stating of the law. It is a reminder. Part of the whole message of Deuteronomy is remember, a reiteration. You know, it's funny, people, we're told that in the book of Acts, Paul talks about the people of Athens, and he says they like nothing better than to hear and tell some new thing. It's amazing. You know, there are folks that are bored with the basics. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to be reminded. They want to pursue some new thing. Well, you know, by new thing, you mean understanding the Scriptures to a greater depth. But there's a lot that God tells us to go back over. He tells us that we're to give meat in due season. Well, the holy days come around every year. And you know, it doesn't matter how many years you've been in the church, when it comes Passover time and Days of Unleavened Bread, we all need to hear sermons about Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And I said, well, you know, I've celebrated that for 30 years. We don't need to study about that anymore. We'll study something else. No, God gives us something that is repetitive, and He tells us meet in due season. Now, I find every year, like in the spring festivals or the fall festivals or whatever it is, no matter how many years I've celebrated them, I can always learn something a little deeper, a little more, just get something out of it, see some connection that maybe I had never noticed before. But a lot of what we're going back through, and a lot of the Scriptures we go back through, Scriptures we've read many times. You know, the Bible is a big book, but if you've been reading it and studying it for 20, 30 years or more, you've read it many times through. But is the Bible a book? You know, other books I read them once and I lay them on the shelf, and I may occasionally go back and make a reference to it sometime if I'm looking for a quote. But the Bible is different. You go through it, and then you go through it, and then you go through it, year after year after year after year. There doesn't come a time when you lay it on the shelf and say, well, you know, I've already read it four or five times, and I don't need to, you know, don't need to read it anymore. No, we need to remember, you see, lest we forget. And so the whole point of this second law was a reiteration. That, I think, is a lesson that we recognize our need to be reminded. Now, you know, it's interesting. Israel, because of their lack of faith, brought a lot of things on themselves. They went through a lot of things the hard way. It's interesting, you know, back in Deuteronomy 1, verse 29, God had told the Israelites, as they were being overwhelmed by their fear of how big the giants were when their ancestors had not entered in 40 years earlier. Verse 29, Moses said, "Then I said unto you, dread not, neither be afraid of them. The Lord your God, which goes before you, He shall fight for you according to all that He did for you in Egypt before your eyes." Now, how did God fight for them in Egypt? You know, did they have to get out their swords and go? No, God fought the battles. God intervened. God took care of Pharaoh's army. And if Israel had followed Him in faith, God would have done the same way with the Canaanites. But, you see, the people found it very difficult to trust God. Now, God had intended them to be a model nation, a nation that the others would have wanted to follow. You know, this will be your wisdom in the sight of the nations. Okay. Now, as we come on into chapter 4 here of Deuteronomy, God instructed them that they were to obey His commandments, not to add or to take away. You see, that's a part of remembering and not forgetting, that we are to be conscious of God's instructions, when people begin to improve on what God has said, you know, there are always problems. It's amazing how people pay lip service to the Ten Commandments, for instance, and yet when you get down to specifics, then, well, they don't really do that one, or they don't take them that seriously. You know, God tells us we're not to add to, we're not to diminish from it. If God says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, you know, the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. Well, yeah, but I don't see why Sunday wouldn't do just as well. Well, God says you don't add to it, you don't diminish from it. I saw a list of quote holy days in a publication we all used to receive, the Worldwide News, and I noticed that there were some that I hadn't known before. Christmas is one of the holy days. Easter is one of the holy days. Now God says you don't add to it, you don't take away from it. We're going to see some other things He says in Deuteronomy that apply to this. So, verse 14. Well, let's pick it up here. We're in chapter 4, verse 13. He declared unto you His covenant, which He commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments. And He wrote them upon 2 tables of stone. So God wrote them in an indelible fashion. He didn't just, write them on a scrap of paper. He carved them in stone. The basis of what is the covenant? He commanded you, His declared to you His covenant, even 10 commandments. So the 10 commandments were the basis of the covenant. That's the basis of the old covenant, basis of the new covenant. The difference is not the commandments. The difference is the medium that God used to write them in. He wrote the old covenant, wrote the 10 commandments with His finger in tables of stone. Under the new covenant, He writes the 10 commandments with His Spirit in the tables of our heart. So that is, you see, to be even more permanent. That's to be internalized. Verse 14, God commanded me, the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that you might do them in the land where you go to possess it. So they were reminded as to what they were to do. In verse 26, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day. You shall soon utterly perish from off the land where you go. You won't prolong your days. This is if you do evil, as He mentioned in verse 25. God will scatter you among the nations, verse 27. And so He reminds them as to what is to happen and what would happen. Well, as we come on down, that God's law, of course, over and over, it's emphasized it's for our good, and we're not to we're not to add to or to take away from God's obeying the law, obeying God leads to blessings and benefits. Now, chapter 5, verse 2, the Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. And made this covenant, not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive today. God made, it wasn't just something that pertained to some other people, it pertains to us. And then He goes through and reiterates the Ten Commandments. Chapter 5, going on down through each of the commandments. And as we notice coming on down here in verse 29, notice what God said in chapter 5 after He'd given the Ten Commandments. Oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. Oh, that there were such a heart in them. You see, the people that agreed to do it, they said they would, but they did not have the heart to obey. They did not have a surrendered, yielded heart. They agreed. But you see, in the Old Testament, Jeremiah 32 and Ezekiel 11, God talks about a time when the Holy Spirit will be given, when God would make available His Spirit and would give a heart to obey. As we come on down, God goes in chapter 6, verse 1, these are the commandments, the statutes, the judgments. Verse 2, that you might fear the Eternal your God to keep all His statutes and His judgments, which I command you. You, your son's son, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. You see, the point is that obedience leads to prolonging our days. It is for our good. Verse 24 of chapter 6, the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Eternal our God for our good always, that He might preserve us alive as it is this day. You know, God's instructions, God's laws are for our good always. That's what people don't understand when they want to somehow do away with the law, is they maybe haven't put it in quite these words, but they've decided that they have a better idea than what God has. God's law is always for our good. That's why He tells us to do it. Chapter 6, verse 18. You shall do all that which is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you. That it may be well with you. So, over and over, the Israel was told, chapter 6, verse 4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one, or there are two or three ways it can be translated. It is a call to listen, you know, hear, O Israel. Hear, hearken, listen to God only. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. This is the verse Christ quoted, you see, in the New Testament, when asked what was the great commandment of the law. This is a crucial point. You're to teach these things diligently to your children. Verse 7. You talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. So you take advantage of circumstances day in and day out to discuss the principles of God's ways. And he tells us, verse 12, Chapter 6, Beware lest you forget the Lord, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. Verse 13, You shall fear the Lord your God and serve Him. Coming on down into chapter 7, verse 1, When the Lord your God shall bring you into the land where you go to possess it, He's cast out many nations before you, all these nations of the Canaanites. Verse 2, When the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, shall smite them and utterly destroy them. Don't make covenant. Don't make marriages with them. Verse 3. Verse 5, Thus shall you deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their images, cut down their groves, burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people unto the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a special people unto Himself above all people that are on the face of the earth. So Israel was to guard their identity. They were not simply to blend in with the Canaanites. God told them, He said, now, all their religious symbols, you don't take those into your house. You don't keep them around. You don't use them for other purposes. You burn their images, break down their altars. You destroy all the things that are, that relate to their gods and to their worship. Verse 25 of the same chapter. The graven images of their gods shall you burn with fire. You shall not desire the silver or the gold that's on them, neither shall you be snared therein, for it is an abomination. Neither shall you bring an abomination into your house. lest you be a cursed thing like it. You shall utterly detest it. You shall utterly abhor it. It is a cursed thing. You know, when you take pagan insignias, you don't have to go very far to prove that the cross is a pagan religious symbol. It goes back to antiquity. A year and a half ago or so, I was in Houston visiting, made a regional trip down there. I guess maybe it's been close to a year ago. And spent Saturday night there with Mr. Ames. And on Sunday morning, we went down to a place in downtown Houston where there was an exhibit of items from ancient Egypt. And right there at the entrance, they had this statue of this Egyptian god that was there at the entrance of the exhibit. And guess what he was holding in his hand? He was holding a cross, which was, there was a sign there, and even referred to it, and said this was the symbol of life in ancient Egypt. This was the symbol of eternal life among the ancient pagan Egyptians. Went back to Tammuz. That's where we get the shape of our letter T from. It was that letter in some of the ancient scriptures actually called the letter Tammuz or the letter Tau, which it was the symbol of Tammuz, and it's come all the way down in that way. Now, when you take something like that and want to make a religious symbol out of it, well, God says that you don't bring abominations into your house. You don't take the images and the things that related to idol worship and decide to use it for the worship of God. God told Israel that they were to destroy those things. This chapter 7 brings back memories for me. It was a portion of the last sermon that I gave on Pentecost in 1993 when the introduction of the cross and several other things were being brought in. And I had had an associate that was the wanted to promote the new things, and so he had encouraged those things that morning, and we got into Deuteronomy 7 in the afternoon sermon to see what God thought of bringing detestable things into our houses and putting them on our walls. That did not go well in Pasadena, but went well with God. That's, of course, what our primary concern has to be. Now, chapter 8 is a very interesting chapter in the way that it ties in such a direct way to the Christian life. Chapter 8, verse 1, verse 1. All the commandments which I command you this day shall you observe to do, that you may live and multiply, go in and possess the land which the Lord swore unto your fathers. Then you shall remember, there's that word again, all the way which the Lord your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble you and to prove you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. Why does God lead us through the wilderness? Why is the Christian life a journey through the wilderness, going through all the difficulties and the obstacles and the ups and the downs? God leads us through our wilderness years to humble us and to prove us. He humbles us by, as He says in verse 3, He humbled you and allowed you to hunger and fed you with manna, which you knew not. You see, how did God humble them? He let them get in a situation where they were confronted with their own powerlessness. He put them in the middle of a place where they had no way of providing for themselves. Because somehow, when we can go and scratch out a garden in the dirt, it's easy to have the illusion that we're self-sufficient, we're providing for ourselves. Well, are we really? You know, you can work hard, but if God doesn't do His part, what's going to grow? You can't make the seed grow. You can plant it in the ground. You can dig it. You can fertilize it. You can do all these things. But self-sufficiency is an illusion. But the more we're doing, the easier it is for us to sometimes get caught up, you know, I'm taking care of myself. I don't have to really depend on anybody. God said, I'm going to humble you. I'm going to get you in a situation where you are confronted with the reality that everything you have comes from me. I'm the source of everything you have. How long could you and I sustain our lives if it weren't for the air God gives us? Well, you know, take away the air and our life is gone in a matter of minutes. Life is not something inherent, existent within ourselves. So God put them in a situation. He provided them their food, clothing, and shelter. They couldn't provide for themselves. He humbled them. God lets us, in the course of our Christian life, get in situations and circumstances to humble us. He humbles us by smashing our illusions of self-sufficiency. And He proves us. He tests us to see what's in our heart. You know, why have all these things happened? People say, oh, you know, why did God allow all these things to happen in the church? To prove us, to test us, to see what's in our heart. If a man gets up and says, you don't have to keep the Sabbath, what do you do? What's in your heart? Do you do it? Do we do what we do because a man tells us to, or do we do what we do because God tells us to, and we believe it? You know, is obedience to God something that's in our heart? Is commitment to doing the work of God, is that something that's in our heart? Was that just something that was important to Mr. Armstrong and he used to talk about it? Or is it important to us? You see, God has allowed us to get into situations to prove us, to know what's in our heart, to see what we really want to do. Because what God purposes to share with us is a whole lot greater than what God was going to give ancient Israel. He was going to give them a good land. But a land, verse 9, as He says, wherein you'll eat bread without scarceness. But He says, verse 11, beware that you forget not the Lord your God. Over and over, this reminder, you see, that we could get how easy it would be to do that. Well, as we come on down verse 18, you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He that gives you power to get wealth. You know, when we're out working and being productive, that's good. We're putting forth our effort. But who is it that gives us power to get well? Who is it that gives us the strength, the energy, the ability to do whatever things we do? Well, He says, you're going to go over the Jordan, chapter 9. And he tells them, he says, now why are you going to get all this land? Verse 4 of chapter 9. Don't speak in your heart after the Lord has cast them out from before you, saying, for my righteousness the Lord has brought me in to possess the land. Don't be lifted up with pride. Don't think, you know, we're really a whole lot better than those other people. You know, the reason we got this is because we really deserve it. We're better. No, it's not because you're so righteous. It's because they were so wicked that I'm driving them out. Not for your righteousness, verse 5, or for the uprighteousness of your heart. But for the wickedness of the nations, I'm driving them out, and to perform the word that God spoke to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So He says two reasons. You're getting the land, not because you're so good, but because they're so bad, number one. And number two, because I made a promise. I made a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So understand, the Lord your God does not give you this good land to possess it for your righteousness, verse 6, for you are a stiff-necked people. So Moses didn't want them to get the big head. He wanted them to understand. And he says, remember, forget not how you provoked the Lord to wrath in the wilderness. And Moses relates the story of how they sinned and there at the foot of Mount Sinai while he was up in the mountain getting the tables of stone. Verse 12 always strikes me as sort of a funny verse. It's the kind of thing husbands and wives say to each other. The Lord said unto me, Moses said, the Lord said unto me, arise, get you down quickly from hence, for your people, which you brought forth out of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. You know, it's like, do you know what your son did today? You know, it's... God wasn't really wanting to claim the people at that point. He told Moses, that bunch that you brought out, they've gotten into trouble. You need to get down and see what they've done. They're quickly turned aside out of the way that I command. And as we come on down, Moses relates that story and how he had interceded with God for them, and how God was angry, verse 20, with Aaron, and I prayed for Aaron also at the same time. And so Moses told them, verse 24, he says, you've been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. God hearkened to Moses' prayer. Chapter 10, the Lord told me, two tables of stone like the first, come up into the mountain, make an ark of wood, and I'll write on the tables the words that were on the first tables. And so, verse 4, he wrote on the tables, according to the first writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord spoke unto you in the mount, out of the midst of the fire, in the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them unto me. He says, I turned myself and came down the mountain. Well, as we come on, notice here chapter 10, verse 12. Now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Eternal your God, to walk in all His ways, to love Him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. To keep the commandments of the Lord, His statutes, which I command you this day for your good. Now he comes on in verse 16, circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart, and be no more stiff-necked. You know, circumcision of the heart is not just a New Testament concept. God told way back initially, you know, we talked about circumcision of the heart, that physical circumcision was a type. So he says, you are, verse 20, you shall fear the Lord your God, you serve Him, cleave to Him, swear by His name. God brought them out. Now, chapter 11, you shall love the Lord your God and keep His charge, His statutes, judgments, and commandments. And again, rehearses how, verse 7, your eyes have seen the great act that the Lord has done. And talks about talks about blessings and verse 13. If you diligently hearken to love God and to serve Him, I'll give you rain in due season. And verse 16. Take heed to yourselves that your heart be not deceived. Turn aside and serve other gods. So. He says in verse 18, lay up these words in your hearts and in your soul. Bind them for a sign on your hand that they may be as frontlets between your eyes. Teach them to your children. And so he tells them in verse 26, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse. A blessing if you obey and a curse if you will not obey. This is in 26, 27, and 28. And chapter 12, going on along this line, these are statutes and judgments which you are to observe. Verse 2, you shall utterly destroy all the places wherein the nations that you shall possess serve their gods. Overthrow their altars, break their pillars, burn their groves, hew their graven images, destroy the names of the mountains. So he says, this is chapter 12 is a key chapter because when we get on down toward the end of the chapter, notice what he tells them in verse 29. When the Lord your God shall cut off the nations from before you where you go to possess them. Then verse 30, take heed to yourselves that you be not snared by following them after they're destroyed from before you, that you inquire not after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. You shall not do so to the Lord your God, for every abomination to the Lord which He hates have they done to their gods. Verse 32, whatever I command you, observe and do it. Don't add to it, don't diminish from it. This was a key section for me. I remember when the first year when I didn't celebrate Christmas. I had gone through and had read and, you know, the things Mr. Armstrong had written on the subject, had studied into it, and of course you don't have to study very hard before you realize it's pagan custom. I mean, most encyclopedias will tell you that. Usually there are newspaper articles right around that time where they freely admit, well, you know, this is a pagan custom we got from this, this is a pagan custom we got from that, and this goes to the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Romans. Well, what does God say? Don't inquire, saying, how did those nations serve their gods? Even so will I do to the Lord my God. So you don't serve God. You don't take pagan customs and adapt them to the service of God. God says that these are abominations which He hates. See, God wants to be worshipped according to the pattern that He has set. God sets the pattern, and we're to follow in it. Coming on down in chapter 13. If there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes to pass, and then he says, let's go after other gods. Let's depart from the truth. Don't hearken. You know, God allowed that sign to come to pass to test you, to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. See, when the false prophet comes along and he works lying wonders, works all sorts of impressive signs, and a lot of people are going to be caught up in that. It talks about how these things are going to be so impressive that if it were possible, even the very elect would be deceived. Well, the key, you see, is right here. So, it comes on down. Chapter 14 emphasizes verse 2, you are a holy people unto the Lord your God, and He's chosen you to be a peculiar people unto Himself above all the nations. He starts out, you see, the Egyptians had various odd things they did in terms of things they making a baldness between their eyes for the dead. They had this sort of shave this strip down the middle of their head and sort of look like punk rockers, actually, when you look at some of these things. And God says, look, you're a holy people. God's chosen you to be different than everybody else. Don't be looking around at what the Egyptians do and what the Canaanites do and trying to be like them. Be different. Be a holy people to God. Then he goes into the food laws, you know, a reminder which had been given before back in Exodus, back in Leviticus, but now he reiterates them. Don't eat any abominable thing. And then, verse 22, goes into the matter of tithing. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year. Eat it before the Lord in the place, you shall eat before the Lord in the place that he shall choose. The tithe of your corn, your wine, your oil, the firstlings, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. Now, he talks about here what we term a second tithe, because it is the second tithe that's mentioned in the Bible. The first time tithing is mentioned is back in Genesis 14, where Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. And we read as we come on through the scriptures up until here of a tithe that was belonged to God that was to be given as Numbers brings out, to the Levites. Here we read of another tithe. This is a tithe that the individual was to consume before God. This is what we use the term a second tithe, or a festival tithe. The money was to be bestowed for whatever the person desired, verse 26. And then they were also to share it with others. Now, verse 28 introduces yet another tithe. At the end of 3 years, you shall bring forth all the tithe of your increase the same year, and shall lay it up within your gates. And the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, shall come and eat and be satisfied, and the Lord will bless you. And continuing right on, chapter 15, verse 1, at the end of every 7 years, you shall make a release. And what we find is ancient Israel operated in in the economic sphere. They operated on a seven-year cycle. The land, most of them were engaged in agriculture. The land lay fallow on the seventh year. The third and the sixth year of each of these seven-year cycles was what's mentioned here in verse 28. There was an additional tithe, a third tithe, not laid up every year, but laid up on the third and sixth year of the seven-year cycles, that was to be used for the needy, for the stranger, the widowless, the widow, the fatherless, and the Levite. These were would be been Levites primarily, who were beyond the age where they would have been working in the temple and receiving the tithes there, and so it served to provide for the needy, and is like a retirement program in that sense for the Levites once they were past the age of where they would be functioning there in the temple service. So this is a part. You see, God prioritizes. He prioritizes our time. He tells us the seventh day belongs to me. So you organize your week around the fact. In Hebrew, the actual names of the days are literally first day from the Sabbath, second day from the Sabbath. You know, each day is named in terms of its relationship for the Sabbath. The sixth day is called the preparation day for the Sabbath. So, you see, the whole week revolves around the Sabbath. The days are numbered by their distance from the Sabbath, or their relationship to the Sabbath. God tells us they're holy days that are to be proclaimed in their seasons. So time, God prioritizes our time. He prioritizes our financial resources. He says the first tithe, the first tenth, belongs to me. That's mine. That keeps you in mind that I'm the one that gave it all. He says, now I want you to come and appear before me every year on these annual occasions. I want you to rejoice. I want you and your whole family to rejoice and to have a good time. I want you to come and learn my ways. And in order for you to be able to do that, that's a priority. That's not something you're just to do if you come to the end of the year and you got enough extra left over, you don't quite know what to do with it, think, well, I'll go down to Jerusalem. No, you set aside a second tithe. Now, it's tithe you use, but coming to appear before me and to rejoice before me is a priority in your life, and so you make financial provision to do that. And helping others that are in need and that can't take care of themselves, that also ought to be a priority. You want to share. That's a priority. So he told them, now you don't do that every single year, but on the third and sixth years of the cycles, the third year, you set aside this time, this third time. Now, as we come on, he goes into chapter 15, matter of the year of release, and goes on into the tendency you see people would have to try to get by with not loaning to those who were in need, not helping a needy brother. So God discusses this, you see. In chapter 16, a reminder about the again the festivals, and one thing we might notice, verse 1 of chapter 16, observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Lord your God, for in the month of Abib the Lord your God brought you out forth out of Egypt by night. You see, we will observe a night to be much observed. They stayed in their houses until morning on the Passover. But then the next day he brought them out on the morrow after the Passover. He brought them out of Egypt by night. And so that's what we see right here in Deuteronomy 16. He talks about leavened bread. Verse 16 of chapter 16, three times in the year your males appear before me. And chapter 17, starts out, you're not to sacrifice any animal that has a blemish. You know, that's an abomination. You, you know, you bring God your best. You don't just have something that you want to get rid of, and so you're going to palm it off on God. He comes on down, and we might notice here in verse 14. When you come to the land which the Lord your God gives you and shall possess it and shall dwell therein and say, I want to set a king over me, then here's the criteria, God says. You set a king whom the Lord has chosen, one from among your brethren, not a stranger. So the king was to be, the king of Israel was to be of the seed of Israel. He was to be an Israelite, the one that God had chosen. The king was told, verse 16, he's not to multiply horses to himself. He's not to cause the people to return to Egypt. He's not to multiply wives, verse 17. Not to multiply silver or gold. Rather, he's, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he's to write a copy of this law, verse 18, in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And he's to read therein, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes. Verse 20, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren. You know, he's the ruler, but he's not to have some idea that somehow he's above the law. You see, this is a fundamental difference in the government of God. A lot of people say, well, you know, this idea of government, God's government or government from the top down, is sometimes the way it's phrased. They say, well, you know, a lot of the that's what the Gentile nations had. No. They had a government from the top down, but the top of the government was the king. The top of the government that God gave to ancient Israel was not the king. God was the top. God gave the law. Now, the king was to govern the people, but the king was under the law. You know, if you want to look at it, Mr. Armstrong used to bring out their four components to a kingdom: the king, the law, the citizens, and the territory. Well, every form, every form of government, you got a territory. But those three components, the law, the king, and the people, the way you configure that tells you what kind of system you have. You know, in a dictatorship, the king is at the top, the ruler. The ruler makes the law, and the people obey, have to do it. In a democracy, the people are at the top, and the people, choose the ruler who makes the law. In God's system, the law is at the top. You know, you have the law, and then the king obeys and enforces the law, and the people obey the king, but the king has to obey the law. The law is above the king, not the king above the law. That's a very fundamental difference between God's government and, let's say, the Egyptian or Babylonian system, or the system of the world. It was, in that sense, a constitutional monarchy. God's law was the constitution. The king was not above the law. You see, the word of the king was not law. God's word was law. Now, the king was there to teach the law, to enforce the law, to govern the people, but he was to do so in accordance with the law. And it is, in one sense, it's very simple concept, and yet it is fundamental. The same principle, you see, God is consistent. I mean, the same thing comes down in the family. See, the husband is to be the ruler. He, you know, as Mr. Meredith wrote in an article years and years ago, being a loving king in your own family kingdom. I think that article dated back to the 60s, and going into some of that. Well, you know, there's the pattern, but you see, the law is the head of the man is Christ. You know, the head of Christ is God. That's what we're told in 1 Corinthians 11. To say I'm the head of my family doesn't mean that I'm above the law, that I'm not responsible to God. Everybody is responsible to somebody, all the way up to the fact that God the Father is the one who is over all. So the king was given instructions, and of course, you know, God didn't want him building up a vast standing army to be tempted to go out and conquer his neighbors. I didn't want him to use his power to get greedy and try to you know, multiply wives to himself, multiply gold to himself, just, you know, use his power to engage in acquisition of great luxury. You don't lead the people back to Egypt. That's what happened a few years ago. You see, that's if the king tries to lead you back to Egypt, you don't follow him back to Egypt. That's why, you know, back when the leadership started going back to Egypt, we at the point we realized where they were headed, we said, no, you know, I'm not going back to Egypt. We came out of Egypt, and that's something that the ruler's not free to do, to lead you back into the slavery that God delivered you from. Then talks about the priests due from the people, chapter 18, verse 3, and goes into some of these things. And as we come on down the latter part of chapter 18, verse 18, I will raise up a prophet from among their brethren like unto you. And God talked about in verse 15, the Lord your God will raise up unto you a prophet from the midst of you, of your brethren, like unto me. So, the prophet like unto Moses. This was a reference, of course, to Jesus Christ, who came also as a lawgiver and a covenant maker. Chapter 19, God talks about the cities of refuge and matters of punishment. Chapter 20, talking about even things that are to be done in warfare, that various laws that you know, verse 10, when you come near to a city to fight against it, proclaim peace unto it. And if it make you an answer of peace and open unto you, then the people shall be tributaries and they'll serve you. So you give them a chance. Give them a chance to surrender. And even to the point, verse 19, laws relating to ecology. He says, when you come in, if you're laying siege against a city, don't destroy all the fruit trees. You know, if you have to chop trees down, don't chop the fruit trees down, because they provide food. Other laws, let's say, relating to crime and punishment here in chapter 22, you shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep go astray and hide yourself. Try to get it back to him. If you don't know whose it is, keep it and wait. Restore it. Verse 4, you shall not see your brother's ass or his ox fall down by the way and hide yourself. You shall help him, lift them up again. You know, if you see somebody in need, then you try to help out. A woman doesn't wear what pertains to a man, neither a man put on a woman's garment. This is an abomination. God's not the author of unisex. He wants women to value and appreciate their femininity and to reflect that in the way they dress. He wants men to value and appreciate their masculinity, to reflect that even in the way they dress. Talks about even a bird's nest. I mean, all sorts of principles here, relating just miscellaneous principles. Take the mother and all the eggs. You know, you do that, and of course, what do? You wipe out the birds. You build a house. They use flat roofs. He says you put a railing around it. So all sorts of all sorts of principles that are brought out as we come on in. Chapter 23 continues. This sort of thing, going through various things, even to the point of giving them instructions about disposal of sanitation, disposal of waste. Verse 12 of chapter 23, you shall have a place without the camp, and you shall go forth abroad. And it talks about how human waste was to be buried. Verse 14, for the Lord your God walks in the midst of the camp to deliver you and to give up your enemies before you. Your camp is to be holy, that he see no unclean thing and turn aside. You know, the point is, they were to have the concept that God is in their midst. God is walking through the camp. God does not dwell in the midst of chaos and uncleanness. Now, you know, this seems like a very fundamental thing, but when you look at all the third world countries that are rife with all sorts of disease because they don't properly dispose of sewage, they have running in open sewers in the streets, and they dump chamber pots out the windows into the alleys and all this sorts of things. You know, because after all, you see, if they don't have indoor plumbing, then it's trouble to go and to dispose of it in another way. God gave Israel a law. He says you bury it. It's principle of sanitation and health. You don't have all these contagious diseases when you've got proper sanitation. But the concept God gave Israel was God is in your midst. You know, now if God wouldn't be in the midst of physical uncleanness, how much less is he going to be in the midst of spiritual uncleanness? There's a concept that needs to be there of considering God is in the midst, and that we want to conduct everything in a way that God is not going to see some unclean thing and turn away. So then he goes on, tells them not to deliver an escaped servant. God allowed the servitude in Israel, but he said, you know, they were not to drag. If a servant escaped, they weren't. He wasn't to be captured and, you know, dragged back. verse 18. Don't bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog into the house of the Lord your God for any vow. Now, he's not talking about... Remember, years ago, somebody wrote in to Mr. Armstrong. They had, they raised and sold dogs. And they wrote in the question, you know, that was it okay to tithe on the sale of dogs based on this verse here in Deuteronomy 23:18. That's not the kind of dog it's talking about. It's a slang term. Referring to a male prostitute. The point is, you see, you don't clean up something unsavory by sort of giving God a little bit of it. the gambling interests have tried to buy respectability by making, civic donations. And so somehow this cleans it up. You can't be going about doing things that are contrary to what God wants you to do, and then bring in some to the, you know, put some in the temple treasury and expect, well, that's okay, that sort of cleans up the whole thing. Well, no. If God doesn't want that sort of tainted thing brought in as though it were, for some holy use. So anyway, he goes on, and as we find here, chapter 24 continues on a matter of some of these various principles that were brought out. It talks about gleaning here in the latter part of the latter part of chapter 24, chapter 25, a controversy between men, and he talks about crime and punishment. Verse 4 of chapter 25, don't muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. This is one Paul quoted in the New Testament, said there's a spiritual principle there as well. Chapter 26, talks about again first fruits and what the priest is to do, and God says that in verse 11, you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given you, and unto your house, you and the Levite and the stranger that's among you. And when you've made an end of tithing all the tithes of your increase the third year, which is the year of tithing. That's the year when all three come due. And you've given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, that you may eat within your gates and be filled. Then you shall say to the Lord your God, I have brought away the hallowed things out of my house. I've given them to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, according to your commandments. So then at the end of that time, to come before God to lay claim on His blessing. Verse 15, look down from your holy habitation and bless your people Israel. So God says, you know, we're to come and we're to lay claim on that blessing. Chapter 27, we have instructions here for this great stone that was to be set up. They were to actually plaster the side of the mountain there. And verse 3, write upon them all the words of this law when you're passed over the Jordan River. And it was here, these stones there in Mount Ebal were to be plastered with plaster, it mentions in verse 4. So, and the law was to be inscribed there. Verse 8, you shall write upon the stone all the words of this law very plainly. So Moses and the priest and the Levite spoke to Israel, saying, take heed and hearken. You shall obey the voice of the Lord. Moses charged the people and told them about what they were to do when they crossed the river, how they were to stand upon Mount Gerizim to bless the people. And there were certain tribes that were to be over there to recite the blessing, and others were to recite the curse. And the Levites, it goes through this curse that was to be pronounced. And chapter 28 continues this matter of blessings and cursings that was to be continued on. God talks about some of these curses. Verse 43 of chapter 28: the stranger that is within you shall get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. He shall lend to you, and you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you'll be the tail. You know, it's incredible when you really begin to look at it and see how much of the property in this nation is actually owned by foreign interests, how much of our national debt is owed to foreigners, how much of the resources of this land. You know, God said the time is going to come. If Israel had obeyed, Israel should have been a blessing to the nations and a blessing to the strangers. Now He says, you're going to come down very low and they're going to go up very high. You're going to find things are going to be turned upside down, and you're going to be the lender, or you're going to be the borrower, not the lender. You know, the United States has gone from being the world's number one creditor nation to being the world's number one debtor nation just in recent years. Amazing, an amazing thing when you look and what is laid out here. The words of the covenant, God said here, chapter 29, verse 1. God again, through Moses, reminds them of what they had seen, what they had done, and what had occurred. Again, this reminder over and over. And he says in verse 18 of chapter 30, he says, lest there be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turns away this day from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations. Lest there be among you a root that bears gall and wormwood. Come to pass when he hears the words of this curse, he blessed himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the indignation of my heart. God's going to deal with that individual. You see, he talks about a root that bears gall and wormwood. In other words, something that is poison, that is contaminating. And someone who has in his heart an attitude of turning away from God and going into what the world has. So the verse 29, the secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. You know, God is, there are a lot of things that we may not know, but one thing we do know is God has revealed His law, His way of life. And God talks about the how He will have mercy on those who repent. Death and life are set before the people. And emphasized to them in verse 19, Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, I call heaven and earth to record this day against you. I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that you and your seed may live, that you may love the Lord your God and obey Him and cleave to Him. He is your life. So here, again, you know, God sets a choice. People say, well, God gives us a choice. That's right. But He tells us what choice to make, and He tells us what the consequences are. Moses is 120, as he says here in chapter 31 and verse 2. So he's not going to be able to lead them anymore. So we're told that he called Joshua, verse 7, set him before them, said, be strong and of a good courage. The Lord will go before you, verse 8. Moses wrote this law, verse 9, delivered it to the priests, the sons of Levi. And they were instructed every 7 years the entire law was to be read to the people. See, they didn't have their individual copies of the scriptures. Wasn't printing, they were to go over that, go over the entire thing. So Joshua was set aside in the sight of the people, then Moses gave Joshua a charge, verse 23, said, be strong and of a good courage. And then Moses made an end of writing the words in a book, verse 24, he finished, and he told the Levites, take this book of the law, verse 26, and put it in the side of the ark. So here is the first canonization of Scripture, the first portion of Scripture being set aside. Chapter 32 is the Song of Moses. You know, when you look at the world and you look at the peoples that are all over the world, the different groups and different ethnic groups, you know, that's not accident, it's not evolution. Deuteronomy 32, verse 7, remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations, ask your father and he'll show you, your elders and they'll tell you, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when He separated the sons of Adam, He set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is His people, Jacob is the lot of His inheritance. You know, God planned things out. He planned out where Israel was to be given inheritance and how that location was, the areas that were set aside for Israel, and the way that God had things lined up. He's the one that divided to the nations their inheritance. He separated out the sons of Adam. All of these things are a part of God's plan and purpose. It's not a matter of accident and evolution. God determined that there be different different branches of the human family, and He purposed as to where, what part of the earth, different branches of the family would be given their inheritance. And God has talks about how God led Israel, verse 12. The Lord alone did lead him. There was no strange God with him. He made him ride on the high places of the earth. He might eat the increase of the fields. He might suck honey out of the rock and oil out of the flinty rock. So come right on down to mineral wealth and agricultural wealth. And we've been made to ride on the high places of the earth. But you see, we're warned that not to become unmindful of God, of the rock that begat us, as it mentions in verse 8, the God that formed us. So there are consequences. This is the Song of Moses. God has plan and purpose, and The people were to be reminded that what they were receiving was a part of God's plan and purpose, but they were not to turn aside from God and think that they would just have it anyway regardless. So as we come on down here to the conclusion in chapter 34, we find that in verse 5, Moses died, and God buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, verse 6. No man knows his sepulcher to this day. Now, you know, there's a reference back in the New Testament when Michael contended with the devil over the body of Moses. There's not a specific account given of that, but I think what would be the tendency of human nature? All the 40 years, the people disregarded Moses, wouldn't pay attention to him. Moses died. The next thing you'd have known, they'd have embalmed him, made an Egyptian mummy out of him, and set him up there and worshipped him, you know, and he'd have been their god. It's just incredible. You know, that's the way people are with things. And God knew of the tendency. Moses, God's servant, God was not going to allow Moses to be, in that sense, that sort of indignity to occur to God's faithful servant. He took and buried Moses himself. They didn't need to know where Moses was buried. They didn't need to make some sort of shrine and idolatrous altar there to Moses. God took care of it. I'm sure the devil would have liked to. Whatever God wanted to do, the devil wanted to do the opposite. And so that's, I'm sure, where the contention between Michael and the devil came from. We're told here in the end of chapter 34, verse 10, there arose not a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. You know, it's interesting. This is a conclusion, really, of the whole Old Testament. Points towards something yet to come. The prophet like unto Moses mentioned back in chapter 18 has not yet come at the conclusion of the Old Testament. The messenger of the covenant that was talked about in Malachi, the end of the prophet, was yet future to appear. So that points, you see, the Old Testament points toward the new, toward the final fulfillment. Deuteronomy gives us a reiteration. There are principles of secular law relating to Israel as a civil nation, many spiritual principles, many aspects of Israel's history. Over and over, the theme that goes through the book of Deuteronomy is remember, remember, remember. Beware lest you forget. Beware lest you forget. That is an important theme for us to keep in mind, because failure to remember the things of God, forgetting what God has done, is the greatest danger in terms of producing spiritual disaster. Well, with that, we'll be concluded with the book of Deuteronomy this evening, and we'll cover the book of Joshua next time.